Okay, so here's a motivation from Sherry. Physically, for me, times are especially tough right now because it's a neurological condition, and it can really mess with the mind, too. Body and mind are separate, but clearly also entwined. So it takes a huge amount of effort at times for me not to just melt into believing the fearful feelings that arise with such force. Even if I end up having a cry now and then, it doesn't last long. I talk to myself a lot, Dharma talk, and I listen to teachings all day long. I go over and over Geshe-la's teachings too. All the teachings you have given are precious, precious. I go over them again and again. I practice when I'm asleep too. A lot of my dreaming seems to be about Dharma. On the upside, too, my meditation sessions are stronger, and adding even just a few minutes longer than deeper meditations have really offered an extra layer of mental strength and peace. Even though I wish it would end, I am mostly just grateful. Without the Dharma gifts I have received, I'd be a real total mess. And I sincerely believe that it is a good thing that this has happened to me for many reasons. For one, it's given me opportunities that being well and busy definitely wouldn't have. It's really empowered my practice. And then she thanks what we're doing. Okay, so use that as your motivation for yourself and to be of benefit to all beings. So I want to start the chapter again because it's been a while, and I'm not sure how many people would have reviewed what we covered already. It would be nice if everybody said, "Oh, I reviewed. I'm ready to go on," but I kind of doubt that. Okay, so chapter 9, page 261. Within the Pali tradition, there are various approaches to the development of serenity and insight. According to the Majjhima Nikaya commentary, serenity includes the 8 meditative absorptions that are the basis for insight. Yeah, and so likewise in the Sanskrit tradition, serenity is a quality. So you may attain it by after going through the 9 stages of sustained attention, but it's not that, you bump it up and you go to the first dhyana, I'm beyond serenity now, I'm in the first dhyana. No, serenity is a quality that is in all the dhyanas. Okay. So some teachers, Pali teachers, advocate cultivating serenity and insight separately and combining them afterwards. Of those, some emphasize developing serenity first, followed by insight, while others teach insight first, followed by samadhi. Still, other meditation masters instruct their disciples to develop serenity and insight together. teachers also have different preferences for meditation objects. Now, what happens to people who want one right way to do it exactly perfectly? After that paragraph, forget it, huh? It was quite interesting when we were in Singapore. One of the longtime students, Xi'an, came to ask me questions about the chapters we've been going through. And she had, I think, 14, 15, 16 questions. I was able to answer some of them, but I couldn't answer others. And when I was thinking about the questions, because some of them were things that, you know, hadn't been talked about yet, or not talked about in this volume. But I wound up saying, when I was thinking about this, you know, there's going to be a lot of difference between practitioners. Yeah, because, you know, some people do it one way, some people do it another way. There isn't one right object that everybody should focus on. It depends on your personality. It isn't like, oh, well, if you go, you know, here is how many hours you have to put in to get to serenity. It's not like that, because it depends on what you're doing during those hours, sitting on the cushion, what you do in the break time, you know, what else is going on in your life. I mean, there's so many different conditions that influence how we grow in the Dharma. You know, and so we have to realize this. And when we do, then first of all, it means don't compare yourself to anybody else, because we're all quite different. And second of all, don't set a schedule for yourself. You know, okay, I'm going to generate renunciation after I've been in the Dharma 3 years. Then bodhicitta, I'll knock that off in 2 years. Wisdom realizing emptiness, that's 1 year. I'll get that real quickly. Bodhisattva stages, zoom through them. You know, if you set that kind of bar for yourself, you're going to fall flat on your face. Yeah. And maybe you'll grow up in the process of it, yeah, because, and this goes for everything in our life. We set ourselves so many expectations of where we think we should be. You know, I'm doing a long retreat. This is, how many times have I done winter retreat? Why is my mind as crazy as it was the first year? Yeah. Oh, I should be over this by now, but I'm sitting there picking faults at everybody. Yeah. What am I doing wrong? Maybe the method is wrong. Buddha didn't teach the right antidote, you know, and they're taking too long. You know, I learn them, but I forget them. And when I practice them, I mean, I do the antidote once or twice, you know, for 2 minutes each time. And it still doesn't, you know, get rid of my affliction. Yeah. What's going on here? So, you know, save yourself some aggravation. Save yourself some time. And, you know, don't set up a schedule with lots of expectations of yourself, okay? Because, you know, what we may see as successful, you know, actually, and we may do something very different and learn something very different in our retreat, but what we're learning in the retreat is what we need to learn at that time, yeah? So, you know, maybe you're meditating. Maybe this is a retreat with attachment coming up every session. You know, you're dreaming about that person, blah, 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 blah. And, or you're angry, and this one and that one. You know, or you're fed up with yourself, or you're jealous of somebody else. And, you know, you just want to be done with all this crazy stuff and get enlightened already. Yeah. right? Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, you start to apply antidotes. And maybe at the end of the retreat, you know, the big thing you learned is maybe you had a particular problem with a certain kind of personality in the past or a certain situation that you often were in, you know, and that kept coming up during your retreat. Well, that's what you need to practice with. And, you know, it may not fit your whole schedule of everything you want to be doing and should be doing, but maybe that's, you know, the thing, one of the afflictions that that has come from a certain thing in the past that you really got stuck on, and it's you know, impeding you, and maybe you work that out in the 3 months and you come out feeling better. Well, that's something good, isn't it? Yeah. You may not have renunciation, but you're going to be a nicer person after the retreat. Yeah, you won't be so grumbly and grouchy. So that's progress, isn't it? You know? And here's whatever it was that happened in the past that used to keep coming up and bugging you, and you have put it to rest now. Yeah? I had an interesting thing happen last week in my practice. You know, I've done a lot of work on forgiveness, you know, okay? And so there was one situation, you know, with one person that had been gone on for a long time. And I had pretty well settled it in my mind and, you know, put it to sleep. And then this thought came up. I don't even know what triggered it, because in this thing, it was somebody I worked with on a project for a long time. And when it didn't work out, we, you know, we had to divide things. And I felt that, you know, I had something we had bought together. I forget the exact thing, you know, but he owed me $250. The grand total of $250. And, you know, and for 20 years, he you know, and in fact, when we had to settle everything, he said, I'm not paying it. And, you know, why? Why aren't you paying it? You owe it to me. Okay, so this came up, yeah, right, yeah, from 20 years ago. So then I started to think about the situation. Okay, he owed me $250 for what? Well, I paid for X. Or no, maybe we split it. We split the price. But if we split it, why does he owe me $250? Maybe I owe him $250, you know? Because we split it, and he got it. And then I couldn't remember, well, who actually got the most out of this deal? And then I had to laugh, because I couldn't even remember the details about what I was mad at, you know? And, you know, the grand sum of $250, you know, after what we've gone through with the Buddha Hall, you know, then I thought some more about it. And I said, okay, it's not the money. You know, I can really throw away the money stuff, you know, put that down. But I just wanted him to acknowledge that he didn't behave so well. And that's why we had so many problems. Yeah, it would be nice. You know, I don't need an apology. Just, you know, just some kind of remark that he recognized that he made some mistakes. And then I thought, well, I also made mistakes. I know about my mistakes in this. But did I tell him I made some mistakes? Couldn't remember. Which probably means no. Okay. And then okay, why do I want him to acknowledge that he made some mistakes? What good is that going to do me? Well, my feelings were hurt. Well, how does him acknowledging he made mistakes repair my feelings? What he did wasn't the cause of my hurt feelings. My hurt feelings came from me, from my expectations, the way I thought things should be. Yeah. So what in the world am I holding on to here? This is ridiculous. Yeah, I don't need him to acknowledge he made mistakes. Yeah, that has nothing to do, as my mother would say, with the price of tea in China. Did your mother say that too? Yes. Yeah. So, yeah, a certain generation of mothers. Yes. Yeah. So, when you meditate and you keep digging into something, saying, well, why is this provoking me? Yeah, then sometimes you come up with really interesting answers. You know, like, I don't even remember what the situation was. Or, you know, or, yes, I remember detail by detail. But then I can't remember what happened after that. Yeah, oh, yes, I remember I got upset. What did I do? Oh, I can't remember what I did. Well, you know, maybe I threw a temper tantrum. You know, who knows what I did? Yeah, so these are the things that come up, but they illustrate different afflictions we have to work on. But they are the nitty-gritty that we use to develop the antidotes. You can't think about the antidotes just abstractly. Yeah. It's like, you know, when you meditate on love, oh, I have love for all sentient beings throughout the universe. Yeah. And then you just think of one other person who didn't fold their laundry correctly, and your love kind of vanishes, yeah? Because you have a standard for how your laundry should be folded, yeah. So, you know, these are how we practice, and we have to practice in real situations. Otherwise, you know, I have bodhicitta for all sentient beings. I mean, it sounds wonderful. And you can sit there and you say it so sincerely. When you're sitting in this room, your stomach is full, you slept enough, everybody's keeping silence, nobody's bugging you, you liked what they had for lunch today. Then it's so easy to have love for everybody in the universe, isn't it? Yeah. But then one small thing, and, you know, our love for all sentient beings, you know, vanishes. So, you know, this is how we practice, isn't it? Yeah. Also, one thing, you know, about we've gone through in this whole section about developing concentration. Excuse me. Oh, yeah, I'm trying to mimic the Tibetan monks. I sound like a sick moose. So, yeah, where was I? What?
Concentration.
Yes, and all the antidotes to the different afflictions, yeah, that I'm sure you all know, because you all have the sheet that Venerable Chuni made many years ago, listing all the afflictions all the antidotes for each affliction, yeah, and I'm sure you have that memorized, yeah. But then, when you're trying to do your meditation practice, whether you're doing Serenity or, you know, Waitara or Lamrim, your mind starts going off to all sorts of other things. Okay? So why does it do that? Habit. Yeah, habit. And, you know, some of our afflictions are just much more interesting than sitting and meditating on precious human life. Precious human life, so boring. I've heard that so many times. Oh, yes, the 18, 1, 2. Okay, let's skip a few. Yeah, yeah, I have a precious human life, yeah. Geshe La starts off every teaching talking about that. Yeah. But the thing is, why do we keep having distractions in our meditation? It's because we haven't really practiced the antidotes. We know what they are, yeah, but practice them? No, because I cannot practice. What this person did is too awful, too bad. Somebody else has to intervene and tell them they cannot do like this. I can't stand it. I'm right and they're wrong. And phooey on the antidotes, you know? This person needs to be called out and something done with them. Right? Yeah? So the first part of acknowledging when we're under the control of afflictions, that first important step we can't do, because we're too immersed in the story of look what they did and somebody's got to stop them because otherwise the world is going to be destroyed. My world in particular. Yeah, everybody else's world, who cares about? Okay, but, you know, why are these things coming up? We haven't really practice the antidotes. Yeah. We may practice them in general. Yeah. But we have to apply them to specific situations to really know how to work with them. Yeah. And once you start applying them and get a handle on some of the afflictions, then, you know, they're not going to come up as much. Or when they come up, you can just say, oh, there's jealousy again. I know. I know it's the story of jealousy. Yeah, I know that already. Forget it. Doesn't interest me. Mm-hmm. But if it interests you, yeah, then, yeah, you can take out all those things of how you've been mistreated and ignored and you've done so well and people haven't appreciated it. And, yeah. Sit and really, you know. My niece used to talk about marinating in the moment. Yeah. But we marinate in our afflictions. Yeah. Okay, but that's why you can't concentrate. So that's why doing the Lamrim meditations and the Lojong meditations and really becoming familiar with them, that's why these are so important, you know, because these are the things that help you look at the situation from a different way, from a different viewpoint, become accustomed to that different viewpoint. And when you are accustomed, then you can gradually start releasing these things. Okay, so objects of meditation in that we're doing now according to the Pali tradition. So there's many things similar to what we've learned so far, and there's also some different approaches. So objects of meditation. Depending on the disciple's temperament, a meditation teacher usually prescribes one of 40 for the cultivation of serenity. 40. Wow. I can choose from 40 objects of meditation. Oh, how about the body of the person I'm attached to? I can concentrate that on that for a long time. Yeah, right? Okay. So there are six kinds of temperaments. Those who are attached, angry, confused, faithful, intelligent, speculative, and scattered. So I all know that you consider yourself the faithful or the intelligent ones. However, you know, you might consider the other ones too. These temperaments depend on a person's habits and the balance of humors in their body. A teacher discerns a disciple's temperament by observing their posture, the way they walk, eat, wear clothes, and engage in daily activities. So there are these 40 possible meditation objects. This is from the Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purification, Buddha Gosa's, you know, wonderful text. So first group, the 10 kasinas. So kasinas are just objects of earth, water, fire, air of the elements, or colors, blue, yellow, red, white, light, and limited space kasinas. So sometimes, you know, we'll get into that. They make a kasina, you look at it, and then that's what you meditate on. The 10 unattractive objects, we love those, yeah. Corpses in various states of decay. What Venerable Yu Munlong, yes, talked about, you know. It's a good thing to concentrate on. Yeah, this, you know, she was doing it in the sense of how she always chases after things, and she's chases and chases, and what does she get at the end of her life? A rotten corpse. Yeah, so it, you know, it makes a step back, and well, what am I chasing and why? Yeah. Okay, so the 10 unattractive objects are corpses in various states of decay. Unlike the meditation on corpses in mindfulness of the body, where the purpose is to understand our own impermanence, here the purpose is to focus single-pointedly on the object with no reflective thought. So you're not thinking about your death and these kinds of things, just the object. Then the 10 recollections are the recollections or mindfulness of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, ethical conduct, generosity, the divine qualities of the devas, death, the body, breathing, and nirvana. Okay, then the 4 divine abidings, the 4 immeasurables, love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And then the 4 formless states, are the basis of infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, and neither discrimination nor non-discrimination. Yeah, and so that we usually call it the peak of samsara, but this is a more descriptive title of it. It's not discrimination, nor is it non-discrimination. Yeah. Okay, so these are meditation objects of beings in the form realms, in the formless realm, sorry. Okay, then one discrimination is discerning the repulsiveness of food. No, we're not going to do that one. Yeah, if I meditate on the repulsiveness of food, then my last bit of pleasure as a monastic will evaporate. Yeah. Okay, and then one analysis is defining the 4 elements. So of these 40, 22 have the counterpart sign as the object. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of new vocabulary words. So I made up, I extracted from the glossary in this, some of those, And of course, I wanted to email it to you, which I forgot to do. Okay, but it talks about here the counterpart sign, which is the meditation object of a dhyana consciousness, a conceptual object that arises as the basis, on the basis of a visible object. Okay. So usually when you start concentration, you start with the preliminary sign, yeah, which is the initial conceptual appearance of a physical object, for example, a kasina, to the mental consciousness. So you look at the kasina, you look at the statue of the Buddha, you know, so the initial conceptual appearance of that, yeah. As your meditation gets better, then it becomes the learning sign, which is a subtler object that replaces the preliminary sign when the meditator sees the mental image of something, a kasina, for example, as clearly with closed eyes as with open eyes looking at it. Now, we hear that and we think, oh, you mean when my eyes are closed, I see the exact same thing as in full technicolor as when my eyes are open? I don't think so. No, because your eyes are closed. That's a mental consciousness that's different than your visual consciousness. So you might have a very clear mental image of it. Yeah. From there, you go to the counterpart sign. So that's the meditation object when you finally get to a dhyana consciousness, a conceptual object that arises on the basis of a visible one. Okay. So 20 of the 40, 22 have the counterpart sign as the object. The 10 kasinas, the 10 attractive objects, mindfulness of breathing and mindfulness of the body. This means the actual object when serenity is attained is the counterpart sign, a clear, luminous mental image or conceptual appearance, which is an object only of mental consciousness. Okay. Although we may begin by focusing on the breath, for example, the breath is not the actual object perceived in deep states of concentration. The sign is. So here the sign, the nimitta definition, the sign or mental object that is the object for cultivating serenity. Yeah, it is of three types, the preliminary, learning, and counterpart nimittas. Yeah, but the nimitta at the end of some, when you use some objects, is just a bright dot, yeah, that appears kind of out of nowhere. So I think with meditation on the breath, you know, the breath is a moving object. You can't develop serenity on an unchanging object with a changing object, okay? So you might start with the breath, and then after a while, what the object becomes is this bright little thing. But some teachers teach that, some teachers don't, yeah? Okay. Although we may begin by focusing on the breath, for example, the breath is not the actual object perceived in states of deep concentration. The nimitta is. Of these 48 recollections, omitting mindfulness of the body and of breathing, the 8 recollections, the discrimination of the repulsiveness of food and the defining of the 4 elements bring access concentration only. So access concentration, those are the preparatory stages before you enter a dhyana. When they talk about access concentration in general, when they say, like, in the Pali tradition that you can attain nirvana with only the excess concentration. That's referring basically to serenity. It's the access to, you know, the preparations, the last preparation before you enter the first dhyana. That's usually called access concentration. Okay. All the other objects will bring full absorption. Any of the kasinas is a condition for cultivating the first five super-knowledges. A beginner initially apprehends the various objects in different ways. All the kasinas, except the air kasina, are initially apprehended by sight. For example, the earth kasina is a round disc made of clean clay about four fingers wide. It is braced up and placed on a board in front of the meditator. So you take a bunch of clay, clunk, make a round disc out of it on a board, put the board in front of you, and you look at that, and then you close your eyes, and the conceptual image that appears to you, you meditate on that. Okay. Interestingly, in the Sanskrit tradition, I haven't heard, when we went through all the objects, there was no explicit mention of kasinas. Yeah. The 10 unattractive objects are also first seen with the eyes. In previous times, meditators went to charnel grounds to view these. Nowadays, you look at an anatomy book. Okay. We did this very early on. You know, we all gathered around Venerable Jigme's anatomy books. This was this was 20 years ago. Yeah. And because the Theravadas have this thing of the 32 body parts. So we were going through the anatomy book, identifying them and seeing what the cleaned up version of them look like. You know, I mean, when things are cleaned up, they look very tidy, you know. But, you know, after somebody's been blown to bits when a bomb's been dropped on them, it's not so tidy. Yeah. Okay. So in previous times, meditators went to charnel grounds to view these. The body's innards are known by hearing descriptions of them. The breath is apprehended by tactile consciousness, the arakasina by sight and touch, and the remaining objects by hearing a description of them. Beginners cannot apprehend the divine abiding of equanimity or the four formless states. Only experienced meditators are able to engage with those objects. Okay, so the 40 objects can be correlated with the various temperaments. If we are aware of our overall temperament, we can get a sense of the type of object that it would be most beneficial for us to focus on. If we have a lot of attachment, what's your guess?
Corpses,
yeah. The 10 ugly objects, and the body is helpful to reduce attachment and focus the mind. So not just the corpse, it could be any of the innards or the outer things. What does it start with? Hair, body, nail, teeth, skin. Yeah, so those we can see with our eyes. Yeah, but here you would take, let's say, skin. Yeah, so you imagine the skin peeled off by a body, on a body, and just put there on the table. What do you think? Yeah, there's the skin of, you know, my precious body. Doesn't it look so great? Of the body of the person I'm attracted to, just this pile of skin. Not so interesting, huh?
or their eyes. Your eyes are like diamonds. Your teeth are like pearls. Yeah, put their eyeballs out there. Just their eyeballs. Then what do you think? Yeah. Or just their teeth. Their dentures is bad enough. Yeah? But imagine their teeth out there. Okay, so it's a good, you know, thing to kind of check up what it is we're so attached to. Okay, so if we are, if we have a lot of attachment, using the 10 ugly objects and the body is helpful to reduce attachment and focus the mind. If we suffer from anger, the 4 divine abidings and the 4 color kasinas are useful. So if you suffer for anger, yes, meditate on love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, you know, and start with, you know, yourself. That's how you start the meditation on love, is with yourself. Not self-indulgent self, but just wishing yourself well and counteracting that mind that is, you know, like, I'm so terrible and I should be doing better. You know, okay. But wishing yourself well. Those who are confused or scattered find the breath a helpful meditation object. Someone inclined toward faith will find the first 6 collections riveting. Yeah, the first 6 recollections riveting. Death, nirvana, defining the 4 elements, and repulsiveness or food are useful for the intelligent. The other kasinas and the 4 formless states can be used by everyone. Before, now this next paragraph is important, whether you're doing serenity or retreat like you're doing now or what. Before going to a quiet place to practice, we should fully dedicate ourselves to the Buddha. Thinking, I give my life to the Buddha. So completely dedicating yourself to the 3 jewels. Yeah. Doing this strengthens the mind. So if we encounter something frightening, we will not run into town, socialize with a lot of people, or give up our practice. Instead, even if a fearful image appears, we won't be alarmed because we have dedicated ourselves to the Buddha. Okay, now, fearful images. Our mind can dream of all sorts of crazies, can't it? Yeah, you had experiences of that? I mean, from fearful images to, you know, of, you know, ones that are unlikely, you know, like a dinosaur coming out of the closet or, you know, something like that. Or ones where, you know, you're walking in town and an ICE official slams you on the ground or something like that. Yeah. So, you know, but it's interesting to practice with all of those kinds of things. And see, you know, if that happened, how would I handle it? Yeah. If you were, you know, going out getting things at Albany Falls and, you know, ICE was there and there was commotion going on and all, what would you do? Yeah. Would you engage? Would you leave? Would you, you know, wish you that you had brought a cell phone so you could record it? Yeah. You know, what would you do? And if officers got mad at you, you know, what would you do? Would you listen to them? Would you give a snarky remark back? Yeah, what would you do? So, you know, it's interesting to think about these kinds of things. I think I told you before that since I was a history major and I read a lot of Solzhenitsyn and then also stuff about from China, yeah, and the revolution and the Cultural Revolution. You know, and then I just kind of practiced in those situations. If this happened to me, how would I handle it? Okay. Because our mind, I mean, we can think of all sorts of nutty stuff, can't we? Yeah. I'm sure we could have some great skits of, you know, the things that we dream up. Yeah, the septic system isn't working. You know, there's a bunch of dinosaurs inside there. Small dinosaurs. There's a kind of, you know, animal that they haven't classified in biology yet. I know that there's a bunch of those, you know, because one day I was walking past that and I saw this weird slimy thing that was, you know, bright green with pink polka dots. And I know there's an ancient dinosaur that used to look like, you know? Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. But there's other ones we can dream up, too, that we get really scared about. Yeah. Like I'm making tea at the tea counter and somebody comes up behind me and goes, boo! Ah! One time, somebody was making tea, and I just came to ask them a question. You know? So, yeah. So, it happens. You know, oh, that happened to me in real life. Oh, no. That's going to happen. I know when I open, next time I go to make a cup of tea, you know? Okay. Anyway. Our mind is amazing. What it dreams up. What we, you know, and what's even more amazing is the things it dreams up that we believe. You know, I mean, these crazy things, okay, we can learn to laugh at. But some of the crazy things we believe, yeah, like nobody understands me. Nobody understands me. It's the same everywhere. And we believe it. Yeah. That's just as crazy as thinking about the green and pink dinosaurs in the septic system. Really, you know? Okay, so we give ourselves to the Buddha, you know? This comes up a lot in the full ordination ceremony. Do you remember? You remember? Maybe you don't. Yeah, they emphasize that a lot. Yeah, you give yourself to the three gems. You give yourself to accomplishing the path. You know, and you make a decision, and that's it. That's where I'm going, that's what I'm doing. Okay. So a good motivation, one that seeks to gain realizations on the path to arhatship in our tradition, to full awakening, is also important, as is a strong determination to confront and work with the afflictions. We should then request our spiritual mentor to select a meditation object for us and receive instructions on how to develop serenity with it as a base. Rushing off to an isolated place with a lot of enthusiasm, but no knowledge on how to meditate, will not lead to fulfillment of our spiritual aims. At the beginning of a meditation session, review the disadvantages of sensual desire and cultivate the wish to be free of it. This is really good advice. After you take refuge and generate bodhicitta, think of the disadvantages of sense objects and sense desire and how it makes your mind totally bananas, you know, and how it causes you so much suffering because you want that, you want this, and you can't get it. Yeah. Okay. recollect the qualities of the three jewels and feel joyful. Yeah, again, this is before you even get into the heart of your meditation. Yeah. Recollect the qualities of the three jewels and feel joyful. If you don't know the qualities of the three jewels, review the initial chapters in this volume. Yeah. Reflect that you are entering the path of renunciation that all the Aryas have followed. That's a nice thought, isn't it? You sit down to meditate, I'm entering the same path that Manjushri, Avalokiteshvara, Samantabhadra, all of them entered. Feel eager to meditate, knowing that by doing this, you'll gain the bliss of Dharma realizations. Not necessarily in that session, but if you keep at it, you will. Okay, we're up to the point now where we stopped before. In the process of developing serenity, three signs, or nimitta, are to be cultivated. The preliminary sign, the learning sign, and the counterpart sign. Using the example of an earth casina, first make the casina disc by filling a wooden rim approximately 12 to 18 inches in diameter with clay, smoothing the clay to get the sense of earth. Place the disc on a stand or raised platform in front of your meditation seat, about 2 feet away or at any distance that feels comfortable. The disc may be lower than your head or directly in front of you. Yeah. With eyes open, look at it, thinking, earth, earth, earth. If it doesn't interest you, I agree. Yeah. You know, to me, you know, visualizing Vaitara or the Buddha is much more, yeah. But for some people, this is really what helps them. Okay, and this is our example. Okay. With eyes open, look at it, thinking, earth, earth. When the image of earth is firm in your mind, lower your eyes and continue to focus and think, earth, earth. Don't ignore the color of the earth, but don't give it prominence either, because the actual object of meditation is the conceptual appearance of earth, which is an object of mental consciousness, not visual consciousness. Yeah. But when you have a mental image of earth, the color probably comes with it. It may come with it, it may not. Yeah. Okay. This mental image is called the preliminary sign. The mental consciousness conceptually apprehends the earth casina seen by the visual consciousness. If the mental image fades, look at the earth casina to refresh your visualization of it, and then lower your eyes and visualize it. This is the same instruction when you're meditating on the image of the Buddha, for example. Look at it, yeah, so that you get an idea of what it looks like. Yeah, lower your eyes and then recreate it. And if you forget, then open your eyes and look again. Okay. Gradually, you will be able to form the image in your mind, sometimes with your eyes open and sometimes with them closed. This is called developing the sign. Yeah, because the sign before was just the external object and a brief image. Here you're developing that. Concentration at this initial stage is called preliminary concentration, and most of your effort goes towards being mindful of the object, noticing when a distraction or other hindrance has arisen, applying the antidotes to it, and bringing the mind back to the meditation object. So when we think about the 9 sustained attentions in the Sanskrit tradition, the first several of them are doing exactly this. Continue to develop the preliminary sign until the learning sign arises. Okay, this is a subtler object that replaces the preliminary work sign. It arises when you see the mental image just as clearly with closed eyes as with open eyes looking at the casino. Okay, like I said, that it doesn't mean that you see it exactly like that. Yeah. At this point, stop looking at the external earth casino and focus exclusively on the mental object, the learning sign. If your apprehension of the learning sign isn't stable and fades, open your eyes and look at the physical earth casino. Investigation is important at this point to establish familiarity with the learning sign. So the investigation is one of the qualities of the first dhyana, where you focus on the object. Yeah. As you continue to meditate, the five hindrances are gradually suppressed by developing the five absorption factors. Okay, so do you remember what those five are? Investigation, analysis, joy, bliss, and one-pointedness. Okay. So suppression in the context of developing concentration differs from psychological suppression. Okay, big difference. Yeah. So when they say that, you know, the five hindrances are gradually suppressed, it's not like psychological suppression of, you know, you had a really bad experience and you don't want to think about it anymore, or your mind pushes it away and stuffs it down. You know, that kind of suppression isn't very healthy because it's going to come up, you know. And so when it comes up, work with it and apply the various antidotes, make peace with it. So that's psychological suppression. Here, when we talk about suppressing the five hindrances, it means applying the antidote such that these things are not so interesting to our mind and don't come up in our mind so much. Yeah. As you meditate, example. One of the first, not the first retreat I did, but the second one I did, 3-month Vajrasattva. Yeah. And when I tell the story of it is, I mostly meditated on me, I, my, and mine, and once in a while got distracted and thought about Vajrasattva. Okay? And sincerely, that's the way it was. I mean, you know, this is when I had the grand remembrance of my second grade teacher, Mrs. Dukaman, who wouldn't let me be in the class play. You know, so these kind of incredibly important things that come up. Third grade, Mrs. Growell, she was nice. 4th grade, Mrs. Lockwood, liked her too. 1st grade, Mrs. Richards. She made us stand, and when she went to the bathroom, stand in front of the door like that. That was weird. Because they had bathrooms in the first grade classrooms, you know, in case you couldn't get all the way where you're supposed to be going. But if the teacher used it, you know, some of the kids liked to pray franks, you know, and they made those doors because they were for first graders, so you couldn't lock it. But if a teacher was in it, the teacher didn't want somebody to come in when they were peeing. So, you know, you had a volunteer That's my grand remembrance from first grade. It's interesting what you remember in each grade. we remember, I mean, so many things happen, and what we remember, the stupid adagios like this. I mean, this poor lady was trying to teach us how to read. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So suppression in the context of developing concentration differs from psychological suppression. Here, the mind and body, what we're talking about here in concentration, the mind and body are at ease and free from stress. The mind is virtuous and the feeling is either happy or equanimous. Unlike psychological suppression, in which the person does not see his mental functioning clearly, here suppression of the five hindrances leads to greater clarity and ability to discern the functioning of the mind. Very different, yeah, because when you're suppressing things and avoiding stuff, yeah, whenever the mind gets kind of close to thinking about that, it gets kind of murky, yeah. But here, the suppression of the afflictions, it isn't like, get out of there, push, 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 I don't want to think about that, I hate it. That's not suppression of the afflictions. It's done, you know, with wisdom and with practice and, you know, losing interest in those things. Okay. Untroubled by manifest afflictions, especially by the five hindrances. You remember what the five hindrances are? Wait a minute, first one? Sensual desire. Ill will or malice. What? Lethargy and restlessness. Sleepiness. Okay, yeah. Lethargy and sleepiness. Then?
Restlessness and remorse.
Restlessness and remorse. And then? What?
Deluded doubt.
Our favorite. Okay. Untroubled by manifest afflictions, especially by the five hindrances, the mind becomes more concentrated. The counterpart sign arises and access concentration is attained. And at that point, you're so excited that you could attain the access concentration that you jump up from your meditation cushion and run around telling everybody. Yeah? No. No. Okay. The difference between the learning sign and the counterpart sign is that the former has imperfections and flaws, whereas the latter is brighter and more purified. Very luminous, beautiful, and vivid, the counterpart sign is immaterial and lacks physical color or shape because it is not an object of visual consciousness. It is likened to a looking glass disc taken out of its case, a very clean mother-of-pearl dish, or the moon coming out from behind a cloud. Stabilizing the counterpart sign is difficult, so you must guard it carefully and practice it over time in order to attain full absorption. Access concentration begins when the counterpart sign arises and the five hindrances have been suppressed. So that is, you're doing pretty good by that point. This is called the stage of suppression abandonment. Now here, the word abandonment, yeah, it's the same Tibetan word, but it can be an English translation, but it has very different meanings in different situations. In here, in concentration, when they talk about the abandonment of the five hindrances, it's talking about the suppression of the manifest hindrances. In other words, those aren't coming in your mind. When we're talking about the union of serenity and insight, let's say, at the path of seeing or path of meditation, there abandonment means that you've cut it off and it no longer manifests in your mind. It's eliminated, it's eradicated. But in the concentration, the context of concentration, abandonment doesn't mean you've abandoned it completely. Yeah. This was actually when Jian was asking me questions. Yeah. One of the statements made in here is, you know, at a certain point, you know, then you're not going to lose your concentration. So she was saying, oh, does that mean, you know, that you're in like the first dhyana or whatever dhyana you're in all the time? You don't lose it? She wanted to know at what point you don't lose it. Okay. Well, first of all, yeah, even you attain a dhyana or whatever, it doesn't mean that you're in that state all day long, 24/7, because you need to come out of your meditation to make lunch, to go pee-pee, to take a walk, to pet the cat, you know. And when you come out of your meditation session, yeah, you're not in single point of concentration on just one object. You know, you better look at where your hands are when you're chopping the vegetables so that you don't include a finger or two. Yeah, so, you know, when it talks about you don't lose your meditation, it doesn't mean that you're always in it, okay? At what point people don't lose their concentration, I have a feeling that is going to depend a lot on the individual, yeah? And what they did beforehand to get serenity, what their daily schedule is after they gain serenity, yeah? Because if you go, okay, I got serenity now, I'll just go back to my regular life, are you going to be able to sustain that ability? No, you have to keep doing that meditation and keep it vivid in your mind. Yeah, it's not just a one-off thing like, I hit a hole in one, okay, been there, done that, now I can stop playing golf. You know, because I know I can never, duplicate that again, or now I can start playing golf. You know, I got a hole in one. Of course, I placed the ball right next to the hole. Yeah. So, you know, these kinds of things, I think so much is up to how the individual is practicing, you know, and what's going on in their mind and what they have to deal with and so on. So this is a very good reason for not to compare yourself to others and not to set up an agenda for when you'll have certain realizations. Okay, we talked about that. So stabilizing the counterpart sign is difficult, so you must guard it carefully and practice it over time. Even you've attained access in order to gain full absorption. Yeah, so it isn't just one off, you got it, oh, I had a good meditation session, okay. Yeah, got that under my belt. Mm-mm. Access concentration begins when the counterpart sign arises and the five hindrances have been suppressed. Okay, there's some footnotes coming up here that are interesting. Let's see. 86. It seems like the access concentration spoken of in the Pali tradition and the preparatory stages spoken of in the Sanskrit tradition refer to the same thing. Each of the four dhyanas has preparatory stages or access concentration that precedes it. Okay. So this is called the stage of suppression abandonment. But you haven't cut off the afflictions. The first dhyana begins with the stable and full development of the five absorption factors. Although the absorption factors are present in access concentration, they are not firm, and access concentration may easily be lost. Okay, so it may be likened to a toddler falling down while learning to walk. You got your access concentration. Next meditation session, yeah, your mind is roaming the universe. Then after that, more concentrated. Then, you know, it's not stable. Okay. But just as an adult, so this is the toddler falling down while learning to walk, which is how I got the scar on my lip. Yeah, I fell down. My parents don't smoke, but they had an ashtray in the house for relatives that did. I fell down and cut myself on the ashtray. And that's why I have a scar here. I'm sure you all noticed it. There's another scar up here, too, from when I drove my tricycle into the back of the car that was parked in the driveway. We won't talk about that one. Okay. But just as an adult can stand firmly for a long time, speak for yourself. Yeah. Can we stand for a long time? When you go to the full ordination ceremony and you're standing for hour after hour after hour, how's that? Yeah. Yeah, like this, huh? Ooh, glad I have neighbors on both sides. Yeah, and in my ordination, people fainted. We were in Hong Kong. No, we were in Kaohsiung in the south, and it was in the hot season, so no wonder. Okay, but just as an adult can stand firmly for a long time, the absorption factors remain strong for a long time during actual meditative absorption. Access, not so much. The mind in full absorption does not perceive sensory objects. Yeah, so your mind completely blocked off from sensory objects. Even, you know, even that person whose voice you can't stand and don't want to hear is shouting in your ear when you're in absorption. You don't hear it. Oh, to not hear certain voices on the news. I won't go any further. Nowadays in Asia, few masters are familiar with kasina meditation, and most meditators use the breath as the object for cultivating serenity. Focusing on the breath slows down the thought processes and clears the mind of the barrage of scattered thoughts. So that's very effective for some people. In our tradition, they recommend breathing meditation at the beginning of your session to calm the mind. Yeah, but it's usually not recommended as the object for developing serenity. But it is done, you know, to calm the mind. But people can choose what they want to use. To use the breath as your meditation object, begin by placing your attention at the nostrils and the upper lip and observing the physical sensation of the breath as it enters and exits. So it sounds very boring, but if you really focus, you know, a lot on your breath and your breathing habits, you can see how they reflect your moods and your emotions. Yeah. And you can get, you know, a hint of what you're feeling or thinking sometimes, if you're not sure, by watching your breathing patterns. Yeah. You can also get, if you're with other people and something's going on with them, yeah, watch their breathing patterns. It can tell you something about what they might be feeling. And what's also interesting, they say, is if you're with somebody who's, you know, really upset about something, match your breathing pattern to theirs. Yeah, so you're breathing in and out at the same time. And then gradually slow your breath down. And if you gradually do that, it can help the other person's breath slow down a little bit, which helps their mind calm a bit. Yeah, quite interesting to notice that. Okay, so use the breath as your meditation object. Begin by placing your attention at the nostrils and upper lip and observing the physical sensation of the breath as it enters and exits. Some people recite Budo to help them maintain focus on the breath, thinking Bud when inhaling and Do when exhaling. So somehow in Thailand, you know, I mean, they would say Budo, they wouldn't say Buddha, because they seem, and everybody, every man's name, at least among the monks, ends in an O, and every nun's name ends in an A, you know, or almost, you know, every monk or nun. Okay, so here it's you're reciting Bud when you inhale and Do when you exhale. Yeah. What's also interesting in our tradition, when you get into Tantra, the breath, when you count one breath, you start with the exhalation and then the inhalation. So one breath is exhale, inhale. Totally the opposite from this and from what we usually do. Okay. The learning sign is a mental image arisen from this physical sensation. When it arises, turn your attention to that nimitta that has arisen based on the breath. A colored, luminous sphere or radiant light, and make that your object to meditation. So that's when you get to the point of the doing the counterpart sign. Yeah. You're not focused on the breath, but on that nimitta. Then the next section is the four Brahmaviharas. They call Brahmaviharas because you know they're causes to be born in the Brahma realm, but because also those gods are peaceful, and so here you generate thoughts that make your mind peaceful. Okay. So the practice of the four immeasurables, or four Brahmaviharas, love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, is common to the Pali and the Sanskrit traditions. This practice may be done in diverse contexts and for different purposes, to soothe the rough emotions, to develop serenity, to aid in the cultivation of bodhicitta, and so on. To have some feeling when you write out your New Year's cards, you know, some feeling of. Yeah. In several sutras, the Buddha presented the four Brahmaviharas as a means to cultivate samadhi. And so what follows is a long quotation. Okay, so the Arya disciple, who is thus devoid of covetousness, devoid of malice, unconfused, introspectively aware, ever mindful, dwelleth pervading one quarter, meaning one direction, with a mind imbued with love. Likewise, the second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter. Thus, above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with love, vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility, without malice. Sounds nice, huh? The Arya disciple who is thus devoid of covetousness, devoid of malice, unconfused, and introspectively aware, ever mindful, dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with compassion. Vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility, without malice. This is also pointing out that if we want to develop these, we have to do something with our hostility, our anger, our malice, our grudge holding. Okay, then the next one. The Arya disciple who is thus devoid of covetousness, devoid of malice, unconfused, introspectively aware, ever mindful, dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with altruistic joy, vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility, without malice. And then the last one, the Arya disciple who is thus devoid of covetousness, devoid of malice, unconfused, introspectively aware, and ever mindful, who dwells pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with equanimity. Likewise, the second quarter, the third quarter, and the fourth quarter. Thus, above, below, across, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he dwells pervading the entire world with a mind imbued with equanimity, vast, exalted, measureless, without hostility, without malice. Okay, so this is a good point to pause and see if there's questions or comments.
Mm-hmm. On page 265, it's talking about 265. So it's talking about the counterpart sign is immaterial.
It's not, the mic isn't.
Hello? I'll speak more loudly.
Yes.
Okay. So the counterpart sign is immaterial and lacks physical color and shape because it's not an object of visual consciousness.
Yeah.
But when we have a mental image, it has color and shape, so I must not be getting something here.
Yeah. I'm not getting that either, because maybe what they're doing is just allowing for... Because also when they talked about the namita for breathing, it has a color. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I can't answer. I don't know. Ask that to our Achan friends.
Okay, can I ask another question?
What?
Can I ask another question?
Yeah.
So if I was looking at or bringing to mind a corpse, I wouldn't be able to just focus on the visual part of it in my mind. I'd be also feeling aversion, and there'd be a lot of chatter in my mind about cringe and yuck and all of that. So You get beyond those thoughts,
yeah,
and then you drill down on the image.
Yeah, you have to get beyond that.
Okay.
This is just, if you're using the corpse, well, you know, you want to feel that kind of yuck, yeah, because it will help you decrease the attachment to the body, yourself, your own body or other people's body. So you want to have that at the beginning, but that's not, you don't want to have that throughout the meditation where you're sitting there, yuck, 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 yuck. Yeah. Okay. And it's good at a certain point, the way doctors and other medical personnel, they have to get used to seeing corpses, and I mean bodies in all sorts of states without going yuck, you know, because if they, you know, if you reacted that way every time, it would be very hard to treat the people. Yeah. Okay, other questions?
When you talked about Budo,
somehow that mic is not
working.
Yeah, I'm not getting...
Is this better?
Yeah, I mean, it has chocolate on it. Hold it really close. You want to lick that chocolate. Yeah.
When you were talking about Budo and they recite it as they're breathing along with the breathing. I've also read that some recite it just mentally, and that that's their object.
Oh, yeah, that's, I think, what they're talking about here. It's not like you're watching your breath going, boo, do. It's mentally you're saying Budo.
Right.
But you're talking about using just Budo as your own the own object. Maybe they do that. Maybe it may not be listed among the 40 objects, but there may be some meditation masters who who do that. Kind of like developing a mantra, focusing on a mantra.
So with that one, you had talked about something moving. Would that be, you know, like with the breath, it's moving because there's the in and the out. So that would be moving. Would you say that's moving because there's two syllables going back and forth?
Yeah, I mean, because at least how they're doing the concentration, it's one object only. Uh-huh. Okay. Now, can one object be two syllables? Put that on the Achan list. Okay. Notice I'm not saying put it on the Geshe list. Put it on the Achan list and see if maybe they know. I don't know. Okay. Yeah?
When we're focusing on the image of the Buddha, are we thinking of just an image or a living presence? And
you want to think of a living Buddha.
A presence,
not
a,
of a statue or a painting.
Yeah. Yeah. But like a presence of that being also?
Yeah. You would have a sense of a presence. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I'm a bit stuck on the 6 of the 10 recollections that I've heard about in a different context. So of the 10 recollections, mindfulness of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, I've heard of those 6 in a different context. It's difficult for me to think of how recollection of the Buddha would be like a single object. I guess I think of that more as like an analytical meditation,
right?
But not one that gets me to a mental state like love that I could then meditate
on. It could be because you have, investigation, analysis, you know, that to get the object, you have to do some analysis to begin with. You know, and this is for most things, you know, you have to go over it and what is it about and what's it like. And, you know, and in this case, if you want to meditate on the qualities of the Buddha, then you have to think about them. It's not just, okay, qualities of the Buddha, gotcha.
Venerable, how would you assess your own temperament if it seems like you're cycling through a lot of different afflictions often?
Oh, really? How many people are wondering that? You know, today it's anger, tomorrow it's jealousy, next day it's attachment, then I have a day with a little bit more concentration. For 5 minutes, and then the next day again, doubt, and the next day, you know, why am I doing this? This is crazy. If my old friends knew what I was doing, they would tell me I would had joined the insane asylum, you know, and I would look at them and tell them, no, they're in this insane asylum, running around in the world doing stupid, useless things. You're cycling through all of that, yeah? Everybody else, I mean, we all know what that's about, yeah? So, you know, if one thing you come out with, of like my Vajrasattva distraction for 3 months, yeah, what I came out with is I need to practice the Dharma, you know, because my mind is just bonkers. And I think that was a pretty good conclusion. You know, that, oh, this is why the Buddha taught the Dharma. This, when he taught about afflictions and the effect on your life, this is what he's talking about. And I saw this in vivid technicolor every meditation session, you know, running through all my afflictions. So your question was, which temperament do you have? Oh, it depends on the day. Yeah? What you should meditate on when these things come up, it depends on the affliction. Okay. So don't worry about it. You're normal. Yeah. It's the people who come and say, oh, I was in samadhi. Those are the people I worry about. Yeah. Okay. Other questions? Well, I'll tell you a little aside from that. So there's some people, some Theravada teachers, not necessarily monastics. The person I'm thinking of is not a monastic, and I don't know if he's still teaching, but anyway, years ago. And he was promising at the end of your four-week retreat at Cloud Mountain that you would be able to enter jhana. Yeah. Oh, you look sorrowful. Yeah. But he promised. Yeah, or he said, this is what the advertisement. Anyway, I knew one person who did that retreat, and, you know, she said she really developed, her concentration really improved. But what was happening, what she called me about, was in the break time, when she was walking around, she would just stop. Like that. And stare for a period of time and then kind of come to and continue walking where she was going. And she was quite concerned about that, yeah. You know, friends of hers were concerned. The teacher said, told her, don't worry about it. You're just going into dhyana for a short period of time. You'll come out. Yeah. So, you know, I didn't know exactly what to tell her because I wasn't the person who taught the course. It's very hard when people come to ask you about meditations that you don't haven't learned that are taught by other teachers, you know, and they're having went to this course, they're doing that meditation, and then they come to you and like, I don't know, ask that person. But that was the answer the teacher gave. I told her basically just, you know, be normal, you know, take a walk, look in the forest, you know, look up and down, look around, be in nature, you know, don't do so many meditation sessions now. You know, something like that. Anything else? Yeah. So you can be glad you're not in danger of that right now, are you? Yeah. Oh, okay. So that's one thing. Yeah. You're safe from. Anything else? Yeah.
Now I'm a little confused. I remember from Venerable Caro's teachings about this subject that we discussed that if you are of a particular type generally, you choose your object and you stay with it. Because if you change your meditation object according to your mood or your tendency of that day, you won't get much concentration.
Yeah.
Is that, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. If you're constantly changing your mind, because you want concentration on one object to be able to hold your mind to one object. Yeah. If you keep changing that object, what's your object of concentration then?
Exactly. But then it's good to know what type of person you are so that you can choose your object. Temperament. Your temperament, yeah.
What do you mean? What kind of... It isn't like, I'm this kind of person. Inherently, I've got to find out which one I am. I don't. It's, you know, what are you attracted to? Yeah, what's in your mind most? I wouldn't worry too much about that.
No, I'm not. It was just that after Teacher's question, I got this confusion. But it's clear now, thank you.
Yeah. Well, if you're having lots of different, you know, alternate days on different afflictions, I would guess at that time there's a lot of confusion in the mind. Does that mean that should be your object of meditation for developing serenity forever and ever? No. Yeah. Okay. We all go through periods of mass confusion, don't we? Yeah? You thought you got it all cleared up. You know what you want to do, what's important. And then you just got... Yeah? And you have to remember what the Catholic nun told me, that when you get confused like this and begin to have doubts and so on, it means that you're progressing. That before you had gotten to a certain thing that was comfortable, you got a little bit complacent in that. Now all this other stuff is coming up, and so that's an indicator that you're ready to grow now and deal with this other stuff. Instead of saying, oh no, I'm falling apart at the seams. No, you're not. You're just, this is the way life is, isn't it? Yeah. So you make adjustments and you go deeper in your practice. But this is also how you deepen your refuge. You know, when your mind just gets really berserky, it's like, I take refuge, you know? You really take refuge deeply, you know? And it's like, now I understand why learning and practicing the Dharma is important, because my mind is unstable. And an unstable mind, you know, it comes out in what I say, what I do, what I think. It affects other people. So now I'm seeing this clearly, and I'm so fortunate to have met the Dharma and know that there's a method to work with this. And now I'm fortunate to know that there's people who can teach me. And I'm fortunate that, you know, my senses function and I can learn this, and I have time in my life and material wherewithal to practice. Yeah. So basically, when you're doing retreat and you're practicing Dharma in general, you're learning to become your own therapist. This doesn't happen initially. You know, sometimes external therapists are helpful. Yeah. But when you work through some really, really heavy stuff, then gradually you get to know yourself, and you learn how to deal with it yourself without falling apart. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I also am beginning to see, too, that so much of that suffering is all that numbtuck that I've thought about myself. And there's so much resistance to putting that stuff down because it's been such a part of identification for so long.
Yeah.
But when you suddenly recognize that so much of that is just fabrication, yeah. And then you start putting down that old stuff, you start seeing that you really like your own company. You know, you can be your own best friend besides being your own best therapist. You actually start liking being around yourself. And then the need to have people fulfill certain kind of things. But dropping the lies is really a big part of Dharma practice, yeah. Is to see the lies we've told ourselves about ourselves.
Yeah. And just identifying this is numtok created by my mind. And with that, we will come to a close this evening. Okay.